Hi, and welcome to the Always Engaged podcast. I'm your host, Kevin Collins. On this episode, I'll be speaking with Courtney Tyler from Hips and Haws. Courtney is a professional forager with extensive knowledge of mushrooms, built up over years of practice. We will be speaking about the benefits of medicinal mushrooms, among other things. There's a lot of information to unlock. I'd recommend to pick and choose information that relates to you. Anyway, let's get into it. A massive welcome to the podcast, Courtney. It's brilliant to have you here.
Thanks. Yeah, it's a real honor to be here. This is lovely.
So can you talk about your journey of how you got into mushroom foraging and where you are today? Any future plans you have in the works?
Oh, that's a big question. Yeah, I guess I was always interested in what was around me that was food or medicine. And it was much more from a herbal medicine perspective. In my young 20s, I studied naturopathy. I'm at the College of Naturopathic Medicine and was always really, really interested in herbal medicine. I would consider myself a folk herbalist. I have really enjoyed the journey of learning how to nourish myself and my family and community and share that. Herbal medicine is people's medicine. I love kind of having those skills be accessible. And I really enjoyed that journey. And mushrooms were on the periphery, but yeah, only I guess about 10 years ago, as I was able to spend a lot more of my time in the wild. As I moved out of Dublin and moved into Wicklow, and I was keeping goats and homesteading and kind of had really changed my lifestyle, that I found myself in the forest more and noticing the abundance of wild mushrooms that were all around us. And I felt a lot of the same fear that I now help teach other people to let go of. I had that fear through, I guess, our culture. We do live in a mycophobic society. We grow up with a lot of fear of how dangerous are they even to touch and just the unknownness. So I had that too. And I was lucky enough to attend the Medicinal Mushroom Conference in the UK through Fred Gillam and Natasha Kenyon a good few years ago. And I met Attila Fodi, who was a Hungarian expert teacher of mine. And I signed up for his 6-month mycology course. And that kind of started the path for me of lighting my own fire, of acquiring more of that knowledge and having, yeah, help the every step towards making them more familiar to me, mushroom by mushroom, just like it was with the plants. And I've never looked back.
Do you see the perspective changing over the years now? Is there more willingness for people to be more adventurous with mushrooms?
Definitely. Yeah, I think I remember when I first started offering walks, mushroom walks in the forest, was probably about 7 years ago. And prior to that, I was working in Dublin for a friend of mine, Chupi, for her jewelry business. And I was in an office setting, which is unfamiliar to me. Most of my life, I haven't spent much time in that kind of setting. But I would find myself Monday to Friday, people would be like, oh, what were you doing at the weekend? And everyone was talking about where they went drinking and what they were up to. And I'd kind of say I was in the forest looking for wild mushrooms. And people would kind of, I don't know, roll their eyes or yawn and kind of like, what is she like? But now I think that's really changed. I think there is even in the last few years, I mean, I've seen it myself through offering the walks, the explosion of interest is really exciting.
Yeah, it's funny that you mentioned that. I think Gen Z seems to be one of the first generations where alcohol use has decreased. And even seeing city centre now, there's a good few pubs that don't serve alcohol. They just have games or yoga nights or painting. So it's really interesting to see how the culture is changing and whether it's better or worse. It's interesting.
It is interesting. Yeah, I have a son who's 23. So yeah, he's a part of that, I suppose. It isn't that he doesn't drink, but he certainly has a different relationship with socializing. And he's already at 23 years old. He's in an 8-year relationship, a really solid long-term relationship. And I just think it's interesting to see that younger generation, how they're interacting with the world is totally different than we were doing.
I even seen it on TikTok the other day. There was a rave in the Guinness storehouse at 7 a.m. in the morning with no alcohol.
Oh, I love it.
It's mad how it's changing, as I said. Like.
Yeah, at the weekend I was out for Paddy's Day Festival. And the reason why I signed up to go actually was a friend of mine said it starts at 5 p.m. It was really exciting to kind of be able to go out and go dancing and DJs. It was a queer party, actually. There was drag queens and DJs. It was so much fun. But it was lovely that it started at 5 p.m. and was done by 11. Kind of suited me down to the ground because I'm not really one that stays out till 2 or 3 in the morning very often, but I had a great time.
No, I'm the exact same. I used to be out like partying till 3-4 o'clock in the morning. Give me a 5 p.m. Rave and I'll be dead set with it. It's funny how like we age.
It is.
So how would you advise somebody starting out with mushroom foraging? Just jump into some books or hands-on experience or?
Yeah, I think the books can get you so far. Sure, if you're interested, it's a good way to start. There's so much information in books and in videos and information online. I mean, endless amounts. I would think one thing would be important is that you get a book and that the websites or videos you're looking at are local to your area, because it does. Well, there's some mushrooms all across the world that we're all familiar with, and some of those facts and ID and their habitat might be the same. There's still a lot of, I think it's quite important they're local, and also that they're very in date. You know, mushroom books, I love vintage things, I love old things, but mushroom books, the information, the taxonomy, everything is changing all the time. So it's important for that kind of thing that you're looking at, really up-to-date information. While I love learning from books, I have a huge library. I just adore my big stack of books and learning from those and holding them in my hands. Nothing beats going out in the forest with someone else who knows, which is why I started doing what I do, because I found in Ireland at the time, there was the amazing Bill O'Dea, who you interviewed recently. He was the first and only person I knew about actually when I was interested in starting to learn about mushrooms. And I just was feeling frustrated with the lack of more people to go out into the forest with and look at them together and pick them up and smell them and touch them, see where they were growing and learn in that way. I learn really well without a hands-on method. So that's become something then that I turned around and said, okay, well, this is something that I can offer the world. I can share that. So yeah, really enjoy bringing people out into that environment, into the forest where we can see things in situ and learn that way.
Yeah, it's a very good point. Different people have different learning mechanisms. I'd be more of the type of person to go out and experience it myself. I remember back in school, I just found history boring, like probably most other people. But now I basically go out and learn history through experience. So like, for example, up in the lead mines near Glendalough, way more interesting going and exploring the mines and going exploring, finding ore and stuff like that, rather than reading it. And then you go back and corroborate with books.
Oh yeah, nothing beats that. It's so empowering, isn't it? To learn through doing and take yourself out into those places. You can learn yourself.
And then like bringing a mushroom field guide out with you when you're mushroom picking. So you can compare what you're picking there and then. It's difficult to do that when you get home because the mushroom might have deteriorated.
Yeah. And actually, I have a thought on that. I think that you need to get to a certain level before that's very easy to do, because I think I remember really clearly when I knew nothing. Like, I certainly didn't have the background of having been so lucky to learn through my family or my grandmother or my parents taking me out every weekend, like some of my Eastern European friends would have just had that as a normal weekend activity. So I learned very much from zero. And I remember having this actually book right here beside me, Roger Phillips Mushrooms. And a lot of people will recommend this as a great beginner's book. And I kind of, while it's an amazing book, an amazing resource, and I love Roger Phillips' work, I don't think it's an easy way for beginners to start. For one, like you, maybe if you're trying to pick up a mushroom in the wild, find it in a book. No book is going to have every mushroom in it, for starters. And for second, you need to have some awareness of terminology in order to properly compare what you're looking at and tick off everything on the list to be sure that you're really sure of your ID. I guess it could be a good starting place. But I think what I like teaching people is learning from the other way around, rather than the more advanced skill, which is certainly just as valid. But maybe it needs a little bit more experience before you're able to successfully bring a book with you and go out into the wild and pick up random mushrooms and know what they are. I think the other way around is a great way to learn, when you focus on, you know, whether your interest is edibility or medicinal mushrooms or simply ID or for culinary food delicious purposes. Whatever your greatest interest is, if you went out with the purpose of seeking out the easy to identify local wild abundant edible mushrooms that are safe, and then you're simply comparing that against a guide it's just an easier way to begin. You know, you've narrowed down a lot of the other way around. You're picking up one mushroom. It could be one of many, many thousands. Whereas if you're looking for certain ID features, say you're looking for cauliflower fungus or, you know, chicken of the woods or porcini or chanterelles or wood ear, jelly ear mushrooms, it's a lot easier to begin in that way because they have, you know, very specific forms and it's a lot safer, I think. I remember my first experience of hoping to find porcini mushrooms and picking up this book, the Roger Phillips mushroom book, having gone out and picked loads of mushrooms that I was kind of going, gosh, I have no idea, but hopefully one of these is a porcini. And then opening up the book, flipping through the pages and wanting so badly for my mushroom to fit into a certain category that I was able to, you know, I didn't really understand enough. All of the little details that need to be ticked off to be sure that you have the exact right thing. And so I found, yeah, I really enjoy teaching from the other perspective, that if you start with a focus of looking for something that you know is about and wild and local at the moment, it's seasonal, it's out, people are finding oyster mushrooms now or whatever it might be, that you go out and you understand what that habitat is first, what kind of trees are they maybe growing on, and you know you're in the right season. It's a lot easier to tick off, you know, the comparisons of, is this an oyster mushroom, rather than what mushroom is this out of many thousands?
Yeah, that must have taken me years, because it took me years to find my first porcini. And with that, it was a recommendation by somebody of the location. If I was given the forest to find it in, I would not have found them. Like, even if you have that information, it's still very difficult. So you need to know the exact location.
Yeah, or you don't have to know the exact location, but maybe the habitat. Yeah, and I know what you mean. It can feel so daunting and impossible at the beginning, but what's so mad, I think, is once you understand the kind of right season and right habitat, and once you've seen and held your first porcini mushroom, there's actually hundreds of thousands. I mean, so many, millions. I don't know how many there are. There are so many in Wicklow alone where we live. I've just seen oceans of them. And sometimes, you know, not just in rare, unusual and successful mushroom hunting days, like if you know the right places to go, talk a little more about that later. But, you know, unfortunately in Ireland, we have a huge over excess of plantations, spruce plantations and mono, you know, forestry at the expense of the native woodland we used to have. You know, Ireland is the worst in all of Europe, I believe, and maybe probably in the world. It's way down in the rankings as far as the amount of native forest we have left, less than 2%. So we have a lot of these spruce plantations. And yeah, I think in those, I have found when you look at the right age and the right place and the right time of year, that's kind of a really rich habitat for some of these edible mushrooms that are highly, highly coveted. And you can find a huge quantity in Ireland when you're lucky in the right place.
You just mentioned monocultures there. I've seen something really good last weekend. Myself and my wife went for a walk in the Devil's Glen, and I could see that they're basically tinning out the forest now at the moment. And you see a notification from Kilche at the start, basically just explaining what they're doing. And I know everybody likes to hate Kilche, but this looks actually pretty decent what they're doing right now.
I did notice they'd marked a lot of trees in there, and I didn't read the sign. Didn't see that. But I know that, Devil's Glen is an amazing, amazing forest. And it is a native ancient woodland. We're lucky to have.
I think it's the best one I've ever seen in Ireland.
Like, parts of plantations in within it, right? But there's a lot of good native stuff in there too. Oh, it's such a beautiful, beautiful woodland. And yeah, I think they're doing a lot of selective thinning out so that everything can grow better. We need a lot more of that continual cover forestry practices. I think culture's starting to change. I've heard that that's on the cards. Hopefully there's more of that.
I think it was COVID that basically changed the government's perspective on it, that they seen how much our forests were being used recreationally, where it wasn't before. Like during COVID, every forest was absolutely jam-packed. And that was probably one of the good things that came out of COVID, is basically got people of realizing what's in their locality and basically getting them to rediscover those things in nature, really.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I was really lucky during COVID to have been invited to take part in a program teaching a select few people forest bathing practices. And it was more of a business course as well. It was how to run a small business. But it was beautiful, just the practice of forest bathing. But basically, what I found most beautiful is in offering that, not necessarily, I haven't offered a lot of forest bathing on its own, but like to bring some of those practices into my walks. Sometimes I found myself reaching out, both through mushroom foraging and forest bathing, though, to kind of seek out new forests I hadn't been to and bringing people to them as well. And a lot of times, even if it's in the locality, a lot of people wouldn't have been so familiar with their local forests, and inviting them into those spaces more and more often. I think a lot of people found the appreciation and magic of those spaces. Yeah, like you said, maybe since COVID, there was a reawakening in how we value those spaces.
Yeah, I thought it was funny. There was some talk about GPs in Japan would basically, instead of prescribing you a box of pills, they would prescribe you a walk in the forest.
Isn't it great? Yeah. Isn't it great? We all need much more of that. If only our doctors said, you know what? Sounds like you're a bit run down and stressed out. Sounds like you need a bit more time in the forest. I'm going to write you a prescription. Work is going to give you a couple of weeks off or a couple of days, and you're going to go out to the forest. Oh, what a beautiful, beautiful kind of medicine that is. That is my kind of medicine.
Yeah, I think there's science to back that up.
Well, there is. Yeah. Yeah. They kind of did some studies, you know, testing people's physiological response to being in those environments and, you know, breathing in the air and, you know, breathing with the trees or breathing out and all of the positive, the way our brain interacts and our body reacts to that very measurable positive response to that. So I think I would agree it is perfect kind of medicine we all could use more of.
Can you tell me about the general health benefits of eating mushrooms? And what about button mushrooms from the shop? Should we be more adventurous?
Good question. So even the button mushrooms have a lot to offer us, but you know, I think we're all quite familiar with those at this stage, and I think in Ireland that's been what's most on offer. You know, most of the time that would be one of the only things you see in the supermarket, and when people think of mushrooms, that's what they're thinking of. But there's, it's kind of like saying, you know, people who say to me they don't like mushrooms, they've only eaten a button mushroom. It's kind of like saying I don't like vegetables, you know, they've only ever had a carrot, but they're just, you know, everything. There's so much more to mushrooms than a button mushroom. So while they have their value and they can be delicious and they're absolutely healthy for you and have medicinal qualities also, there is so much more to offer. And it's been really nice to see more cultivators stepping up and offering a lot more edible wild culinary mushrooms. So seek them out in your local markets and support them, because there is an ask in your local veg shop or supermarket for them to get more wild mushrooms in, because there's so much delicious flavor and texture and amazing nutrition for our bodies. So I like to start by sharing there's so many ways that they're good for us, but from a culinary and dietary perspective, one thing that they give us, sounds really basic, is dietary fiber. which is really important. And we're all deficient in that in our Western diets. We just simply don't have enough generally.
That's good for insulin resistance as well. There's a lot of people with diabetes here.
Yeah, absolutely. And so mushrooms are the highest source of dietary fiber, bar nothing. So it's a great way to start getting more of that dietary fiber in your diet. But then the reason why their fiber is so good for us, why mushroom contains so much of that, is because they're composed of chitin, which is a hard, like the exoskeleton of crustaceans and such things. And our body doesn't break it down very easily. So because of that, when we eat mushrooms, they go into our gut and they act as a very good prebiotic, feeding the other. They're hard to break down, so they feed the other bacteria in our gut, increasing biodiversity in our gut and overall health markers. There's all the, you know, obviously by having strong gut health, we know the benefits to mental health as well, the access of mental health and gut health and how they're connected. So there's a lot of good reasons to be eating mushrooms. Another thing they do, I like to share this in my medicinal mushroom courses, I also do a really lovely mushroom charcuterie advanced mushroom cooking skills course. So for both of those, sometimes talk about the fact that mushrooms and fungi are actually a distant cousin of humans. We are more closely related to mushrooms and fungi than we are to animals, and fungi are more closely related than plants and mushrooms are. And you know, we're all in our own different kingdoms. There's the fungal kingdom, there's the animal kingdom, we're all in our different kingdoms. The fact that animals and fungi are really long distant cousins, we evolved from a common ancestor way back, and I think that's really cool because there's something that mushrooms do that humans do, and this benefits each other. Mushrooms, when they're exposed to sunlight, also produce their own vitamin D, same as we do as human animals. When we have our skin exposed to sunlight, we make vitamin D, and we make a slightly different kind than the mushrooms do. You know, one of them is vitamin B2, one is vitamin B3. So when we eat mushrooms for vitamin D, we need to eat a bit more regularly in order to acquire the vitamin D. It doesn't stay. When we make the vitamin D with our skin in sunshine, that can persist for months in our body. But the kind that we get from mushrooms is still really, really valuable. It just needs to be eaten a little more regularly to stay in our system, which is no bad thing because there's endless amounts of studies that suggest eating more mushrooms is beneficial. The countries, the people, the cultures that have a regular practice of consuming mushrooms, you know, a few times a week as a minimum, that it correlates with very strong incidences of, you know, far less cancers, far less morbidities, much greater robust health. So there's, you know, a lot of studies that suggest the correlation has to do with eating more mushrooms and a lot of good beneficial health outcomes.
When you talk about vitamin D, I got really deep into looking at my genes, and I noticed a lot of Irish people, they're missing the two pairs that basically allow you to produce vitamin D. So a lot of Irish people, their ability to produce vitamin D is probably down less than 10%. So even if we went out to the sun, we wouldn't get vitamin D from the sun. I found that really quite interesting that, like, I didn't think about why if you left mushrooms out in the sun, they absorb the vitamin D. I never thought why that is, but it's interesting. We need to supplement more like vitamin D.
Yeah. And in Ireland, I didn't know that from a genetic perspective that we were, you know, more prone to having less vitamin D from the genetics, apart from the fact of the pale skin. You know, having pale skin means more difficult to, I think darker skin produces vitamin D more easily. But then also living in Ireland, you know, we don't have a lot of very sunny days where we have our shirts off and we're out in the, you know, getting enough sun on our skin. So yeah, we know that, I guess, especially during COVID, we understood a bit more the relationship between our immune systems and vitamin D being a really important part of that, though something that contributes to our well-being and our immune systems. But mushrooms on many levels, in every level, they impact our immune system, most of the time in a very beneficial way. So the act of eating more mushrooms, drinking more mushrooms, making medicinal mushroom extracts, consuming of mushrooms in all the ways that you can are absolutely strengthening your immune system. So yeah, through lots of different methods, but one of them being vitamin D.
In terms of more medicinal mushrooms, can you list off the known ones that are beneficial and their uses?
Gosh, there's so many, but maybe I'll focus, maybe just for the purpose of that question, maybe ones that we can find in Ireland easily. Although I'll also touch on, you know, maybe one of my favorite ones. I've just named my new dog, my border collie, after. So my dog's name is Reishi. And Reishi is a really powerful medicinal mushroom. And we do have Reishi family mushrooms, I suppose, Ganoderma mushrooms in Ireland. So they would act in many of the same ways as reishi, or the more kind of studied Ganoderma lucidum or Ganoderma resinlindi, I guess, is the most official reishi. And that's in Asia. So that one's been studied for thousands of years. So powerful. It is one I would not want to live without, especially for the reason that as I was growing up as a human, I had lots of allergies, especially hay fever. I was really allergic to nature. Very frustrating and upsetting. And most of my life I took antihistamines because it would be so debilitating. And while many things have helped me on my path to being more robust and healthy and kind of overcoming my allergies, reishi mushroom is a huge part of that. So one thing was strengthening my gut health through fermented foods and through eating more mushrooms, especially milk kefir, that kind of ferment, and all kinds of diverse ferments, you know, kombucha, kefir, sauerkraut, kimchi. I eat a lot of fermented foods. That started helping my gut be stronger and my allergies decreased a bit. But I was still living with the chance of, you know, constantly carrying around antihistamines, because if I had an attack of allergies, it would be really debilitating. I met Martin Powell from Myconutri. He's got a few different brands of mushrooms, but he's a biochemist from the UK who has the brand Myconutri. And I really enjoyed, he'll be in Ireland speaking again in May. Highly recommend going through Ivywood. When I heard him speak a couple of years ago, he said in that talk how much he recommended that people use reishi if they were suffering from allergy conditions like hay fever. And I immediately went home and started my daily practice, or most days practice, of having reishi, and my allergies absolutely disappeared. It was just so life affirming and exciting, because a lifetime of living with them was really, you know, I really felt the weight of that. And I think in top health, ideally we wouldn't have to be suffering these kinds of things. So it's reishi is one mushroom that I can't talk enough good about, but there's so many others. Chaga doesn't really grow in Ireland. It's been reported possibly in the Mourne Mountains, but it's one that I like to work with. But I think it's something that, for sustainability and for health reasons, is one that shouldn't be overused or relied on. It's not endless. It's not as potent in its cultivated form. I prefer it wild because it derives a lot of its medicine from the birch tree. So when it's cultivated on sawdust, it's going to be different.
Can you explain a little bit about why it's not sustainable?
Mm.
Just explain about how it grows and what it's taken from the tree that it's growing from as well.
Yeah. So a lot of mushrooms can be cultivated and be just as good and just as valuable. I love it when I can get them from the wild. But, you know, oyster mushrooms or shiitake or many others can be, lion's mane can be very successfully and deliciously cultivated. But some mushrooms, I'd more prefer them definitely to be wild. And chaga is one of those. So chaga derives a lot of its medicine from the birch tree. So betulinic acid is one of them, but it...
Triterpenes and polysaccharides in that as well.
All mushrooms have those. Yeah. So I think there's the interesting question about these trendy mushroom coffees and how maybe... Well, there's a couple of questions in that. You know, you can kind of buy the sachets, and there's a few different brands on offer in Ireland, kind of a growing industry of these mushroom coffee products that are kind of like fast food, you know, easy sachet, pour it in your cup. And maybe to varying degrees, they're offering us a lot of good medicine, sometimes maybe less so. There's a question over, you know, how much, if something's really filtered through like a coffee filter, you might be losing all those polysaccharides, which are long chain sugar molecules that are quite gelatinous, so gel-like, and they would get stuck in those filters, and then you wouldn't be getting that, a lot of the medicine, you know, it'd be stuck in the filters. But chaga is one that I wouldn't recommend people using too much. It's not something you should have every day, both for sustainability, because when it's harvested from the wild, it takes a long time to regrow, for one. And also there are practices of it, you know, often being over-harvested and harvested in unsustainable ways, where perhaps they cut down the tree because it's just quicker to get the chaga off of it than to cut it off carefully and leave a growing edge that it may grow again. So yeah, for both sustainability and for your body, that is one mushroom that shouldn't be overconsumed. The oxalates in chaga could be really hard on your kidneys to have long term. So you should use it as medicine when needed. But there's a lot of other mushrooms that are just as delicious and medicinal that you could reach for that don't have that kind of warning, because they can be cultivated. And most mushrooms don't have contraindications like that.
Yeah, I think for people who don't know much about chaga, other mushrooms would grow on the ground from mycelium. And with chaga, it grows as a kind of a black, kind of lumpy stump on the side of a birch tree. And then to cultivate it, people will just chop that off like you would a piece of wood. And it literally looks like black wood that people grind down.
Mm, black and orange. It kind of has an orangeness on the inside, doesn't it? And black kind of burnt look on the outside.
Yeah, it doesn't look very appetizing, but...
No, and it isn't appetizing. It's not a food. That's an interesting distinction between like culinary mushrooms and edible mushrooms and medicinal mushrooms. Like some medicinal mushrooms, you can eat them as well. But a lot of them are hard and woody. They grow on trees. A lot of the medicinal mushrooms would have that kind of that similar form as chaga growing on a tree and being very hard and woody, in which case you need to really extract the qualities to be able to consume the medicine. It isn't as simple as, you know, cooking it up for dinner.
Same as reishi. I've seen people growing them in greenhouses and that's literally got the texture of wood. You could probably hit somebody over the head with it. Can you explain a bit about birch polypore if we're talking about birch trees?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I love the birch trees. There's so many of my favorite mushrooms that grow on and around it. Amanita muscaria also grows with base, so does porcini. And then on it, there's the chaga if you're in the more northern climes. Like I said, not so common in Ireland, but chaga could be found more like Scotland or the far north. But then in Ireland, we don't get a lot of chaga, but we do get birch polypore, and a lot of people would call it white chaga sometimes, as in it's going to contain some of the same qualities from deriving its medicine from the birch tree. I guess that would be one I'm able to interact with a lot more than chaga, because it is so abundant in Ireland. We have a lot of birch trees and yeah, the gorgeous birch polypore growing on it. So it's a fun mushroom to interact with, both as food and medicine, making paper from it, all kinds of things that you can do, making a plaster if you cut yourself in the woods. What I have done mostly with birch polypore is I make a decoction in a slow cooker. Sometimes I make a double extract with the alcohol extract and the water extract and combine them. But even just in its decoction form from a slow cooker, a lot of my medicinal mushrooms, when I make an extract, a water extract, I would put them in a slow cooker for anywhere between 12 to 72 hours. And then you consume that water. So basically what that decoction does, it's so different than herbal medicine with plants. With mushrooms, because of that cell wall, that chitin that I mentioned, a lot of the medicine is bound up on the outside of and within that cell. So in order to be able to access it, we need to extract that in a few different ways. Usually it's through water, that long, slow, warm water extract, which is going to let those polysaccharides that are bound up in the chitinous cell wall, outer cell wall structure, it lets them kind of unravel into the water. So they're technically not actually water soluble, but in that water, in that warm water, it kind of allows them to unravel into the liquid. And they're kind of like a gel almost. Sometimes you can see them, if you let them settle to the bottom, there's this kind of murky gel at the bottom and it separates and you kind of think, oh, maybe it's gone off, maybe it's gone wrong. You make your double extract and sometimes those kind of fall to the bottom and it looks like something's gone wrong. But actually that's the medicine. So you need to shake up your medicinal mushrooms before you consume them. And when I make a decoction in my slow cooker, then consume the liquid, the water that's there, I'm able to consume a lot of the medicine from the mushroom in that form. And I find it really good for gut health, you know, maybe for any kind of gut dysbiosis, for IBS, for upset stomachs, kind of just there's a bitterness to it. Like a lot of mushrooms have, that bitterness is always going to be good for our guts. It stimulates bile, helps digestion. But I have had a lot of people come back to me and say that they, after adding birch polypore into their regime, kind of felt much less symptoms of their IBS or other digestive issues. Also good for skin conditions too.
How often would you be taking it?
Well,
As needed?
As needed. But for most medicinal mushrooms, it's really interesting and really reassuring to know that you can kind of interact with them as food. You know, it's while they're very potent medicinally, while they're going to be impacting and benefiting our immune system and our gut and giving us nutrition, they aren't something that we have to really be super uber cautious with. In most cases, while there are a few contraindications, like some mushrooms, if you take them regularly, like reishi or jelly ear, they have a certain blood thinning quality. So that for some conditions, if you were going to go for a surgery soon, you know, there'd be some contraindications for overconsumption of mushrooms that had that quality. But most of them don't. There's very few contraindications. And the exciting thing is you can kind of have them as food. So if you just have the practice of, you know, making your decoctions in the slow cooker or cooking more mushrooms for your dinner, that's going to just benefit you. There's not going to be any downsides to that. So as with everything, you know, don't overdo it. I wouldn't imagine you'd be drinking liters and liters of it every day. But you can kind of really consider them food and eat them and consume them as you would food.
You talked a bit about turkey tail because it's something that we find everywhere. We forgot to mention that you created the Facebook page Mushroom Foraging Ireland that has 17,000 members at the moment. And congratulations on that. What we noticed is it's very popular for people to be posting turkey tail in there at the moment. It's just one of the more common mushrooms for people to find.
Yeah, it's a great starting mushroom for medicinal mushrooms to kind of seek out in the wild. You can have to be found on dead hardwood logs, you know, fallen oak or other things. And sometimes when you find it in like a hole. If you, you know, if it's a good day, whole fallen log is going to be covered in beautiful turkey tail. And sometimes, you know, there's thousands of fruiting bodies in the log. And the good thing to know is you can harvest away, you know, every fruiting body that's on that log. If you harvest and pull off those turkey tails, if they are in good condition, that tree, that log is going to continue to produce more turkey tails because that mycelium is within the tree. It's with it, the substrate's consuming that tree as it's dying, and its role is to, you know, keep on eating what food there is in that tree and producing more fruiting bodies. So it's going to keep on doing that. There's no harm in over harvesting those turkey tails. Yeah, there's a few, there's a lot of lookalikes, but none of them that are dangerous. But you want to kind of use a resource like Mushroom Foraging Ireland on Facebook to verify your finds. So it'd be a really good place to kind of go, you know, I think this is a turkey tail. What do you guys think? Do you agree? And take good photographs of the bottom, the top, and have them in focus. And you'll get a lot of supportive people kind of, yeah, reaffirming what you found is the right thing or it isn't. And learning through that way. But turkey tail is a really medicinal mushroom, and it's probably the most studied, has the most clinical trials to back up its efficacy through time. It's been used in cancer treatment in Asia for a long time, alongside modern medical practices for combating cancer. It can be really beneficial to use together with, you know, chemotherapy or radiotherapy in cancer treatment to help your body survive the onslaught of the poisons you're giving it to kill the cancer, and also at the same time benefiting your immune system. So whether it's to prevent cancer and hopefully ward off what a huge risk and fear that is for so many of us. The numbers use like 1 in 3 or 1 in 4 of us are going to get cancer. So the consumption of more mushrooms like turkey tail and all the ones that I've spoke about are going to be beneficial in helping you maybe have better chances. But if you've already got cancer and you're going through treatment, you know, turkey tail is an amazing mushroom to add to your regime. And whether that's through the decoction method with the slow cooker that I mentioned, that's the way it's often used as medicine. Also, another way is the double extract. But I think its use in Asia was usually through its water extract.
That's what I was going to say, is that I've often picked turkey tail out in the forest, but then when I got home, I don't have a slow cooker, and I was just, what do I do with this? Because is it effective enough just to add it to boiling water and just cook it for an hour?
You'd be getting some medicine from that, but you'd be losing out on a lot of it. And another thing you could do with it, I like making extracted powders. So in my medicinal mushroom course, we talk about, you know, processing mushrooms like turkey tail and in other ways. So I actually, turkey tail is one that's normally not consumed. You usually wouldn't eat the whole fruiting body, but I like making that one as an extracted powder. And for both the purposes of its medicinal qualities, but also for that dietary fiber, when I've taken the whole fruiting body and extracted its medicine through the water method, through the decoction in the slow cooker, and then blend up the fruiting bodies in a really powerful blender with the liquid that's been extracted, then I have a thick slurry, a big paste of turkey tail extracted liquid, extracted because it had that long slow water treatment already in the slow cooker. When I blend that up in a very powerful blender, if it's a cheap blender, it's going to break your blender in no time. I have a Vitamix, which is really powerful and strong. And then I lay that out in the dehydrator on trays. It's a thick slurry or paste of turkey tail. And then dry that out, kind of rip it into smaller pieces, as it's going to turn into a really hard piece of mushroom leather, basically, if you let it dry in that form. But I kind of cut it up into smaller and smaller pieces. And as it gets paper dry, then I re-blend it again in the blender. So it turns back into powder. So in that form, we've unlocked its potential. We've extracted through the water method a lot of those beneficial polysaccharides, beta-glucans, alpha-glucans, in that long, slow water extraction. And then by taking the fruiting body and blending it up, another method you could do is in this pressure cooker rather than a slow cooker. But we could, yeah, in my course, I guess we talk a little bit more about the differences of what that could be, also beneficial.
Does temperature and that affect?
Yeah, temperature matters, but it's been really interesting. Christopher Hobbs is a teacher that I was lucky to meet in Portland, Oregon, when I was speaker at the Radical Mycology Convergence, which was amazing. It was really lovely to meet him and Robert Rogers and so many heroes of mine, so many people I love learning from. But Christopher Hobbs' book in particular is one I really recommend people if they're interested in medicinal mushrooms. His most recent book, Medicinal Mushrooms, lays out really clearly these different methods and how to make your extracts. I think it's a wonderful resource, very up to date. Yeah, if you're more interested in learning how to make these extracts or extracted powders, or why it's different just to boil it for an hour as opposed to 3 days in a slow cooker, his book is quite good at outlining the hows and whys to do that.
You mentioned with chitin and the effect on gut bacteria. Are you removing any of that effect if you're making a double extract?
Yes, good question. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, usually in a double extract, it's the water and the alcohol extracts combined, but you've taken out the fruiting body, you've strained that part out. So you're there in that form, you're not getting the beneficial fiber. You're not getting the fruiting body itself. You've still extracted loads of the medicine, but maybe less of that dietary fiber, that beneficial for the action directly on your gut of feeding that kind of gut bacteria and things through the breakdown of the chitin. But there's also, you know, so many other ways in which these mushroom extracts are going to benefit our gut health too. But you're right in that form. You've taken out the, in most cases, you've taken out the fruiting body and strained that out. So that part isn't its biggest offering anymore.
Yeah, that's what a lot of people don't realize is the gut contains something like 500 million neurons. So neurons are the brain cells. You got 100 billion of them in your brain. And then the gut connects to your brain through the vagus nerve. The vagus nerve regulates the nervous system. We'll talk about parasympathetic, sympathetic nervous system in a while. But it's just really interesting to see there has to be a massive connection between mushrooms, gut health, and mental health in general as well.
Great point. We touched on that earlier, but yeah, all of our guts are compromised through our lifestyles and antibiotics and, you know, pesticides in our food and current agricultural practices. And, you know, we all, most of us, I'd say, kind of like the convenience of foods that are processed, and all of that has a toll on our gut and also the stress we live with. So yeah, how we eat is really important, and that's a huge passion of mine. So I don't know if you followed me last year when I was a participant in the Wild Biome Diet, but a Wild Biome Project.
I didn't actually notice.
Ah, right.
Sugar.
Oh yeah. Well, I was one of 28 in Ireland in the UK, and it was headed up by Monica Wild. And we lived for the purposes of a gut health study. Professional foragers like myself lived for between 1 month to 3 months on wild food exclusively, only wild food. So nothing cultivated, nothing processed, no sugar, no coffee, no wheat, no gluten, no sugar, no chocolate, no anything like that. We lived pure wild. So acorns and seaweed and mushrooms and venison and fish and wild greens and wild garlic and roots. And that was what I lived off of. And it was astounding to take part in that. I'll be doing it again in a couple of weeks. I'm going to do that for the month of April. Yeah, it was for the purposes of studying how that impacted our gut health.
Did you take gut samples before and after?
Yeah, we did. Yep. They also studied our blood nutrition and our hormones and our blood sugar. We wore kind of blood sugar monitors on our arm as well. So it was fascinating to take part in. And I'm really feeling a year later the lack of, I mean, I felt the full vitality of how that changed me and what it gave me for almost a whole year. Even though I only participated for 5 weeks, that we were invited to take part for 1 month or for 3 months for the purpose of the study. They wanted a 1 month cohort and a 3 month cohort to see how it impacted us. And it was really astounding that even with 1 month, how our guts were able to change so drastically and the sense of well-being that we all felt. So it was such an honor and such a challenge and such a beautiful thing to do and feel how that changed me in more ways than I can yet articulate on many more levels than just physical. So I'm really looking forward to participating again for just informally, not a part of the Wild Biome Project, but a lot of us who participated are going to do it again for a month just to kind of get the boost again and reconnect in that way, because it was a beautiful challenge.
Apart from the personal experience, reviewing your results before and after, was there anything that struck you as amazing, out of place?
No, it was really hard. I think we're still kind of waiting for the translation of the tests and what they mean. And it's still an unknown science. We still don't really know exactly what is good gut bacteria, what is exactly bad, what quantity is this or that, and how different it is for every person and every part of the world you live in. And it's very much based on what it is you're feeding your body. So everyone in the world has, you know, depending on where you are in the world, have very different communities of bacteria living in our guts and all kinds of different balance and good balance or dysbiosis. While sometimes some are considered bad, they're beneficial in some other ways. So it isn't an exact science. And I think we've all felt some sense of disappointment in how difficult it was to unpack the results. There was a program on the BBC Food Program where they were kind of two episodes, actually, where they touched on our study. They kind of more so kind of formulated an overall general overview of how we were all impacted rather than on a more individual way. But I think it's just so much data. It was so difficult to unpack, and it's still an unknown science. So the study will be repeated again in 2025. I do recommend following Monica Wild. She did this for a whole year with her partner, Matthew Rooney, and they wrote a beautiful book called The Wilderness Cure. And it's a beautiful story of living wild like that and the ways that it impacted them. So if you're interested in that, do follow up.
I'll definitely 100% be checking that out straight away. Can you tell me some of the mushrooms that you consume on a daily, weekly basis? What's your go-to?
So I don't do anything every day, but I intend to and try to have reishi most days. Like I said, for my allergy response, I found that life-changing. So I would try to have in one form or another, whether it's extracted powder or capsules or tincture that I've made or some extract, I would have reishi most days. I suppose then there's nothing I'm doing all the time of all the rest. I have my extracted turkey tail powder, which I put in my kefir smoothie this morning. Really important to have that mix of good gut bacteria and alive food like kefir with extra fiber. That combination to your body is like you're feeding the good bacteria, but then you're feeding the other bacteria in your gut at the same time, so you get ultimate benefit. So that would be something I would incorporate regularly. I often have my slow cooker out. And then, by the way, if you don't have one, just look on Facebook Marketplace. People give them away all the time because it sits on their counter and there's no room for it. But they're very easy to get for free because no one uses them anymore. For the purpose of medicinal mushroom making, I mean, it's such an easy thing to do. You just throw your, even if it's shiitake mushrooms that you're going to cook in your miso soup, no harm in making a really rich extracted broth, your decoction that way. If you just give it a few more hours or overnight, you're going to be able to have so much more of that medicine available to you than simply just cooking them.
With reishi, would you be taking that for longevity, or is that more to do with the gut bacteria again?
Okay, so for reishi, I would take it for a multitude of reasons, not just for the benefit I have for allergies, but it's kind of the emperor, the king, the queen of all mushrooms. When you read about traditional Chinese medicine, it would be the one that has the most accolades, that you read it and you kind of go, God, this is good for everything. It's a little bit overwhelming even. You know, you can take it and it can support with so many different ways. And I just found it interesting to note that almost all of my teachers, from Robert Rogers to Christopher Hobbs to Martin Powell to many others, all of them take reishi every single day. So I just thought, okay, well, that definitely sounds, they definitely know all about this stuff. So if they do that, I'm going to do it too. And the rest I don't take on an everyday basis, but I would often, you know, I definitely intend to, whether I've picked wild mushrooms, I've been lucky on a walk, whether I've cultivated some, sometimes I just on a very basic level grow some oyster mushrooms, or sometimes lion's mane, or sometimes the magic variety, sometimes play with cultivation. I'm not a madly successful cultivator, but I enjoy dabbling in it. I need to give it more space and more time to be more successful. But so whether they've popped up outside on a log that I was growing, or I was lucky on a walk that I found some wild mushrooms, or I support the local cultivators, there's new Ashford mushrooms down the road, growing all kinds of lovely mushrooms. So I intend to eat them at least 3 or 4 or 5 days a week. I would have dried ones from the autumn. So yeah, probably couldn't say I eat them every single day, but probably most days. And that's, there's too many to mention, but I find that very nourishing. And I do find, I'm 46, no one ever believes my age, and I do feel a sense of youngness and vitality that I do attribute to my diet and lifestyle.
You don't look it.
Thanks.
Mushrooms are quite popular in health food at the moment. I'm not sure if it's a fad. Do you think that they're overselling their benefit, or do you think it's potentially underselling?
I think underselling. I think it's a fad, but I think it's a reawakening. I think it's a disconnection we've had for too long. I think the East has known all along. They've never forgotten. They've been introducing, you know, they've had medicinal mushrooms, edible mushrooms in their everyday, in their medicine, in their, you know, cancer treatment, in their dinner table on every level all this time. And they've known the benefits of that. And it's kind of just, you know, long time coming in Ireland, but, you know, other places, other parts of the world, like the Pacific Northwest and Vancouver, Portland, and California, and lots of other parts of the world where it's been kind of reawoken a little longer than here. I think underselling. I couldn't say enough. What I love to teach in my workshops is exactly why it is you'd want to be interested in mushrooms, why it is that you might want to be adding more than button mushrooms to your dinner table, and what you can get from that is just still, it's too hard to put into words. I think there's enough resources that are kind of all hinting at what this gives us, but I don't think, it still just doesn't seem to be fully acknowledged for the magnitude of what they can offer us. And I feel that in my bones. I feel that in my health and my vitality. And I read it in all the resources that I to learn from. But I think it's underselling. I think we could all do with more.
I completely agree. I look at mushrooms from a longevity perspective. I kind of follow the likes of David Sinclair. I take mushroom supplements on a daily basis. I'm not very good at listening to my body, so I don't know what I need. So I just brain prey technique. I take supplements for about 3 weeks and then like I cycle them, go off them then after that. So.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, I think it is worth noting while I'm saying that all these mushrooms are very beneficial to you. There's a lot of power in knowing how to process them yourself. And methods such as this slow cooker method that I talked about, it couldn't really be more easy. It's just a question of time. It's very simple, very low tech. But there are a lot of dubious practices. When something is worth, an industry is worth so much money, there's a lot of room for corruption. And when we're buying anything in a powder or in a capsule, there's a lot of room for disingenuous selling practices and corruption. There's a lot of money to be made. So, you know, such things as some are of possible value to take the whole substrate of your sawdust that the mycelium is in and, you know, incorporating that as something that is a part of the medicine. So if you've kind of taken, you know, there is some value in the mycelium. So if we were to say, okay, well, actually, if I'm a medicinal mushroom company and I've grown everything onto sawdust as my substrate, if I were to, you know, can't really extract the mycelium from the substrate. So I'm just going to log everything in the dehydrator and blend it all up. And so it could be the case that in many circumstances, what you're buying is a lot more sawdust than mushroom. And you don't know that if you're swallowing a capsule or you're buying a powder on the internet. And it isn't a question of, you know, where can I get this for the cheapest price? It is important to kind of, for one, if you're going to buy commercial supplements of mushroom powders or any powder, really, or something in a capsule, you really want to trust, have some knowledge of how it's processed or how it's tested to trust what's exactly inside that. And unfortunately, the chain is so convoluted, you know, something like Hollands and Barrett's, not singling them out by any means, but any kind of chain company that's going to sell health food products, the chain below them from where those things are all acquired is so convoluted and messy that I'm sure that it's impossible to actually follow up and to be able to sell a product they can stand behind in every case. There's a lot of times that things are studied and tested afterwards and in fact don't contain any of the active materials that they should do. So I do recommend that if you aren't as interested or don't yet have the time or resources to make your own, but let me assure you it's simple once you get a few simple kitchen implements and some time and know-how. It's really simple and there's no better way than to know and trust the integrity of the medicine that you're taking because you've got the mushrooms locally, you've harvested them either from the wild through foraging or through a local cultivator. You know exactly what you're starting with. You know that you've extracted it in the proper ways, that you have the most potent medicine. Whereas if you do buy capsules, unless you're buying from a company that you really trust, that's a hard thing to do. So I do like to invite people to engage with why it is they might want to make these things themselves. And also realize that not everyone has the time and space to do that, but seek out people who know what they're doing then.
You don't know what's in bulking agents and in mushroom capsules. It might say 500 milligrams on the front. If you look at what's actually inside it, probably a lot less than what's reported.
Yeah, especially from the perspective of stating the polysaccharides. Because if they say simply this is how many polysaccharides are in this extract, that is a disingenuous and misleading way. Because if in fact it were sawdust, that is a carbohydrate, which is the sugar. And so by simply stating the number of polysaccharides, they're giving you a figure that is absolutely skewed and is no reference to how many mushroom polysaccharides. So if it says beta-glucans, that's a very different thing. You'd want to be knowing the quantity of beta-glucans in your extract or, you know, if they can test the triterpenes and all the other things, and you can trust the results of those testing. You can then really much more, you know, you can invest then in those products that are going to give you a beneficial and strong positive, you know, they've been produced in the right way and you can trust that. Whereas if you simply, you know, some people would say to me, oh, but I found this great company, they're selling it for €7 a bottle. That is no reflection of the quality of what's inside. So you really need to ask some questions. Is it simply a mushroom that's been powdered, which could have culinary purposes and benefit for your gut, but it's not going to have any of the medicinal mushroom extracts unlocked inside that? So is it a mushroom that's extracted mushroom powder? Has it gone through a process of water and alcohol extraction and then been dried and powdered? There's a lot of questions there, so it's worth asking. And if it was extracted and powdered, was it from the sawdust and the mycelium or was it the fruiting body? So there's a lot of questions more so than just buying whatever cheapest supplements you can find on the shelves. And again, yeah, it's really reassuring to know that you don't have to have a fancy lab to make these extracts at home. And it doesn't have to be something that you spend a lot of your time doing. It can be, you know, one big, you know, you buy a lot of lion's mane at the market from the local cultivators and you make a big batch and you share that with your friends and community. But that could keep you going for a long time. So it doesn't have to be something that you spend all your time doing to receive the benefits.
I was looking at doing it before and it seemed a bit intimidating. I thought that I needed a lot of professional machinery to create double extracts, but that's quite eye-opening. We'll move on to the fun stuff then. So let's talk all about Amanita muscaria. I've read Amanita Dreamer's book. I found it great. It opens up a lot of thinking. Can you explain it more about the mushroom and what people are using it for?
Yeah, first of all, I had Amanita Dreamer over in Ireland last year. It was an honor to have her visit and host her for a shared event we did together, which was a lot of fun. We may do another one in 2024. We're still formulating that. But yeah, she's an incredible woman and her work around this mushroom is second to none, really. So I had my own experiences that led me on the path that I'm on to learning. So it was interesting to connect with her and to meet her and work with her after we'd both formulated our way of working with this mushroom because they differed in some ways and her experiences were very different to mine, but we used it in very different ways. And that's kind of, for me, what is very exciting. There's no one answer and there's no one method. Amanita muscaria, the fly agaric mushroom, is something that I have become quite known for. I have found that my experiences with this mushroom and the way that I've used it as medicine and as food have connected me to this myriad of life experiences and challenges and growth and adventure. And I attribute all of that to fly agaric. I feel like it's been my mushroom guide. It's been very exciting to have it, to feel It's medicine on my body, which was an external use, an external application of the tincture on my body when I was suffering from a lot of sciatic pain after a bike accident in Dublin. This was about 10 years ago, and I was nearly paralyzed, sometimes paralyzed, from pain of sciatica. I'd wake up a couple of mornings and my body simply wouldn't move, and this went on and off for a good number of years. And while physiotherapy helped me from time to time, it would help me temporarily, and the pain would always come back. And I learned through a Finnish teacher of mine, who I also had the honor of meeting, which is Henriette Kress. She's a Finnish herbalist. She has a website called Henriette's Herbals. She was teaching this old Finnish remedy using phlegeric fresh sliced up in vodka. And now I just want to say this is a very different method than any other mushroom making. This is a different thing. The active compounds in this mushroom are water soluble. So I believe that when we're using something as like vodka, what we're really doing, vodka would be, say, if it's 100 proof vodka, that would be 50 ABV. So it would be 50% ethanol, 50% water. What the alcohol and the water in the fresh mushroom are going to do, the water that's in the vodka, the water in the fresh mushroom, they're going to be extracted into that water. They're going to kind of, yeah, leave their qualities into the water. And the alcohol simply exists to preserve that extract. So we're not talking about any other medicinal mushroom extracts. This is a different one. This is for a different purpose. And this is for external pain relief. And so it's a really simple method. You need to have the fresh caps of phlegeric and you slice them up and put them in vodka and let it sit for 4 to 6 weeks. Shake regularly, strain it out. And that liquid is magical. It has changed so many people's lives. It's been so exciting to be a part of sharing my personal experience and then later teaching now many hundreds of people in Ireland and abroad how to use this medicine really safely for external pain relief to absolutely life-changing effects for many people. A lot of people have come to me with chronic pain, with severe debilitating conditions that nothing else has helped. And this very simple extract, externally, a few drops only, has changed so many people's lives. So it's for that reason that I teach about it and talk about it and share about it. If it wasn't that I hadn't experienced it myself, it sounds too fantastical to believe. There's many other ways to work with phlegeric. There's ways to have it as a delicious food. It's one of my favorite culinary mushrooms when prepared properly. So please don't go out and just cook your phlegeric. It needs knowledge. Same as cooking kidney beans. They need to be soaked and cooked for a long time to be rendered safe and edible and not toxic. Same as raw chicken is toxic to us until it's cooked. Also, you just need to know the simple methods to prepare phlegeric for it to be safe and delicious as food. But yeah, knowledge is key. When you know how to harness the power of these things, whether they're plants or mushrooms, important to know. What are those active compounds? How do they work, you know, and to do it safely? But it is easy to teach and share this knowledge with people. And it lights me on fire because I have seen firsthand how many people have had their lives changed in a very positive way from the first thing that could finally help them with chronic pain they lived with for a long time. A lot of people, also this man with Parkinson's, came to me on a walk and was very eager to explore using phlegeric to help with him with his debilitating and degenerative Parkinson's symptoms. And he has shared the most beautiful stories with me, the ways in which he has absolutely been able to hone a recipe that has helped him immensely with his symptoms. So it's just so rewarding to hear these stories.
Is that external or internal use for Parkinson's?
He was using it internally for Parkinson's.
That actually makes a lot of sense. Would you like to explain a bit about what muscimol and ibotenic acid and anything else that do within the mushroom?
Yeah.
Kind of find that interesting that Amani the Dreamer kind of makes it seem that it's an adaptogen and it works on the nervous system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the active compounds are the ones that we most know and name in phlegeric and Amanita muscaria are ibotenic acid and muscimol. There could be trace amounts of muscarine, which is a dangerous toxin, but there's usually such remote trace amounts it's not in dangerous levels at all. And it's not always present either, but muscarine would kind of give you a sweating sensation and in other mushrooms can be to levels of quantity that are very dangerous. In phlegeric, it's almost negligible. So the two main toxins and medicines, depending on what way you look at it, say it, and what knowledge you have, are ibotenic acid and muscimol. And so they both work with your body in different ways. They both are contained within the mushroom in different quantities. Very interesting and not so easy to explain in a quick sentence. But the way that you prepare the mushroom has everything to do with your end result. And what you're hoping to achieve is very much going to inform how you prepare that mushroom. So when we have a raw, fresh phlegaric mushroom in our hand, it's going to be about 90% ibutinic acid and about 10% muscimol. But depending on how we dry it, what temperature we dry it at, how we prepare it, how we cook it, what temperature and for how long, and whether we lower the acidity, all of these things are going to convert the ibutinic acid into muscimol to give us a different experience. So yeah, it's not a simple mushroom to talk about, to teach about, to understand. But I think that if it's something that interests you, you don't need to go into all of that. If you wanted to interact with it, for one, you could interact with it from its beauty and just take photographs and see it in its being in the forest. You could interact with it in the way that I teach in my workshops, this external tincture for pain relief. Very, very safe. And then you don't really have to understand all of the other chemistry that's involved in this mushroom. But should it be interesting to you to understand that a bit more deeply? There is so many nuances to how that's prepared and what those different levels of those two chemicals are going to offer us in its medicine. Yeah, make no mistake, ibutinic acid is a neurotoxin, but so are many other alkaloids we consume regularly, such as, you know, caffeine and nicotine and all kinds of other toxic alkaloids and chemicals that we consume in our bodies daily. So dose determines the poison and the medicine. And in this case, there can be some medicine in both of those things. How we prepare it is going to inform everything. So I would always guide people towards Amanita Dreamer's work for the internal use. And her new book is really, really good at laying that out. All the information is also for free on her website through hundreds of videos she shares. And I have microdosed with phlegaric also. And it does can help a lot with insomnia, with anxiety, with ADHD symptoms, all kinds of things when used properly. But what I think is beautiful is working with phlegaric. If that interests you, that you have to create a relationship with yourself and this mushroom, and it's a lot of listening into yourself. You go really, really slowly. It's extremely safe if you learn how to start slowly and, you know, calmly and quietly, you know your intention. Then you play with the ratios of those two main chemical compounds and preparation methods. But I would recommend, you know, I'm not going to teach in a quick podcast how to microdose or how to take it internally, but I think what I'm trying to say is developing that relationship is key, that you start to listen to your intuition and you go very, very slowly, and through experiencing it in your body, if that calls to you, you can do that extremely safely and, you know, in a methodical process that could be the key to helping with issues that otherwise many people don't find a satisfactory answer to, like whether that's Parkinson's disease and the really strong drugs that have to be taken, that this man was able to substitute his microdosing of phlegaric internally with. His doctors were astounded at the benefits he was able to achieve without the heavy drugs that he'd always been given before. Like, blown away by the results that he was able to achieve in himself and his body. Just, he shared a beautiful poem with me and just shared the full beauty of what it felt for him to be able to take some control of his health himself and to have the knowledge to work with something really simple and really safe when used properly. It's complex, and I stumble over my words sometimes if I have to try to describe it in 10 minutes because there are so many nuances to it.
One of the things that fascinated me from Amanita Dreamer's book was about muscimol. So a lot of people online are trying to increase as much as possible the amount of muscimol and then reduce as much as possible the amount of ibutinic acid. And the reason for that is that muscimol acts on the GABA receptors in the brain, similar to how benzodiazepines work. So in terms of anxiety, they're using muscimol as a treatment for that. But the thing that I found fascinating was that ibutinic acid works on the sympathetic, muscimol works on the parasympathetic nervous system. So from her book, she's pointing out that you need the two of them to bring your body into kind of a homeostasis. And a lot of people don't think about that. It's like a seesaw. You push one thing in too far of a direction, the other side doesn't come down. You want that seat to be in a balance. So
So actually, if you do have her book and you follow her method for making a standardized dose for a tea that you might microdose from, yeah, that general recipe that she shares most is kind of like a 50-50 of balance of both of those things. So rather than a full conversion over to muscimol, or rather than the ibo heavy experience, you know, those would be on the two outer extremes, if you listen to her teachings, the two edges of the seesaw. You know, they're the extreme ends. They're going to go way up or way down, and you're going to have a very strong experience one way or the other. Whereas, you know, should you be interested and you learn to make a safe and nice standard dosage from which you can microdose, you can have kind of more close to a 50-50 ratio, which is what she teaches for kind of generally going to help the most people in that general middle ground rather than going to the extremes. And it really is interesting because it's a quagmire of information on the internet, and it was always like, you know, how can this mushroom be perceived as so very dangerous in so many books for so long and told that it might kill us even if we touch it, to this other extreme that we know that it's been used in shamanic practice as medicine, for journeying, for, you know, as a hallucinogen, as an entheogen, as a powerful medicine for shamans and for other people to see into other worlds and to personal growth and all of those things. How could it be that they're both? And how could it be that in France or Japan it can be consumed as a delicious food? How can it be all these things? So it's certainly an enigma, and it's a difficult place to just Google the internet because you're going to come across all these different conflicting information. So yeah, important to understand, you know, what is the risk, if any, what ways are safe preparation methods, how can it be? It's just all about knowledge and finding places that are reputable sources of knowledge that you trust. So yeah, one of my favorite offerings has been this full day workshop in Amanita Muscaria, and teaching the exact, with more time, a whole day to kind of unlock and break down, you know, what are the risks? What are the dangers? What is poisonous? What is toxic? What is a toxin? How do we detoxify? How do we use that toxin in that toxin in another form? Is that another word for that is medicine? When we break it down to dosage, you know, how can it be beneficial? And how could it, you know, what are the dangers? So that's something, it's a conversation that takes a little more time. And I love those offerings. It's been such an honor to be able to offer that to the world and to have those workshops. So I have a weekend coming up very soon, actually. The first weekend in April, I'll have one day will be medicinal mushrooms and the next day will be fly agaric. So if anyone hears this podcast in time, but I do offer it through the year as well. So I'd love to see you on one of those workshops sometime if you ever interest. Yeah.
Oh, 100%. I definitely will be. Can you tell me about the legal status of Amanita muscaria, and does it fall under the psychoactive bill or is it just in a grey area currently?
Yeah, so in Ireland, it's in a grey area. It's not technically the only mushrooms that are criminalized are psilocybin-containing mushrooms, so magic mushrooms, you know, Liberty Caps or Psilocybe cubensis or any mushrooms that contain psilocybin are illegal in Ireland. And Amanita muscaria does not contain psilocybin. So it's not technically illegal. However, it is grey because it does fall under that psychoactive act. I can't remember the year of that act, but basically it was enacted in Europe. Do you remember?
2005, I think.
2005, thank you. Okay, I'll remember that now.
I think so.
Because there was a lot of people, I remember back in that time, a lot of people seeking herbal highs, just buying anything on the internet that gave a high, and, you know, things that technically weren't illegal, but were very psychoactive. And there was kind of that, again, that question of buying mystery pills and powders on the internet, you know, some danger involved in that. Some of these plants can be very powerful, and just because they're not illegal doesn't mean that they should be just consumed willy-nilly. So they did put in an act to kind of criminalize anything that was psychoactive. So there is a gray area here because it does depend on its intended use. And so my teaching of fly agaric is this external method. Primarily in this method, there is no kind of high, there is no intoxication, there is no hallucination that's going to happen from this external application. So the way that I'm teaching it, and it does have a history of use in this way, so it all depends on the wording. However, yes, it's certainly grey. So in some countries, it's criminalized and illegal. In the Netherlands, interestingly, Amanita muscaria is illegal. But in most parts of the world, it's not. It's just kind of in that murky grey area. And hopefully we see these things being hopefully changing, you know, especially the question of psilocybin. I mean, there's no question now about its benefits and its potential to create medicine in many ways to us. And it's being decriminalized in many parts of America now. And hopefully, yeah, that's changing everywhere. So I hope to see that be reevaluated in Ireland and Europe soon.
Have the results of that study in Trinity College about psilocybin come out yet?
Oh, I don't know, actually. I'm not familiar. I haven't heard any updates.
I think it's just absolutely crazy that you can get, well, technically you can get arrested for picking up a single Liberty Cap in Ireland.
And not only arrested, a class A drug in line with heroin. So, I mean, yeah, no joke. I don't know that anyone gets prosecuted for that, I say, but that's technically the word of the law. So, yeah, we know it's changing. I'm sure you're familiar with Entangled Life by Merlin Sheldrake. Oh, if you're no. not, oh my God. Okay, and then the other book I'd have to recommend is How to Change Your Mind by Michael Pollan.
Oh, yeah.
So no. You probably know him, right? Have you familiar with his work?
Yeah, he has a show on Netflix with the same name.
Yes, it's exactly.
It's brilliant.
It's brilliant. So his book is beautiful, and I really like a lot of his books. He's an American journalist, used to be more of a food journalist, but He's now done, he's got a lot of beautiful books, but How to Change Your Mind was very moving about, you know, his exploration using his own body and experience as a 50-year-old American journalist, trying out some of these powerful entheogens and reporting back how he felt them and how they changed him and how he experienced them. And it was really nice for him to use his profile and his voice as a respected journalist to kind of break down some of the stigma that was very strong around psilocybin or other magic mushrooms and kind of this super criminalized and, you know, perspective that probably mushrooms never should have been in. You know, they're nothing like heroin. There's nothing the risk there that they should be in that category. Entangled Life is by Merlin Sheldrake, and I highly recommend you seek it out. It's a beautiful book, and not only a book to hold in your hands, but to listen to his audiobook version where he reads it himself, and he's got just a beautiful voice that I'm so taken with. And I was really, it was so brilliant. I went to London a couple weeks ago to watch the opening of his most recent film. It was in the IMAX in London in Waterloo Station, and he was opening in that night, and it was beautiful and so inspiring to hear him talk. He took questions before and after, and he speaks with such clarity and such passion. And his book is Entangled Life is about all the ways in which fungi interact with us and the ways they change us as humans and change the world, and they're involved in our technology and all of the systems through the world. It's just the most beautiful book and very inspiring. And then his newest film was narrated by Bjork, and it was involved a lot of time stop animation. Just absolutely stunning. I highly recommend watching it. Hopefully it comes to Ireland. I'm not sure if it's showing in any of our IMAX theaters, but we need to ask so that they do, because it was just so moving and so beautiful.
Absolutely love Bjork as well. You could get it in the Lighthouse, hopefully.
Yeah, hopefully. We have to ask. I know Ireland's small, and I don't know, is it too niche to be watching a film like this here? But I don't think so. It was absolutely breathtaking.
I don't think so either. We've had some of the smaller films, like The Quiet Girl, like on Colleen Kuhn. They show a lot of local Irish stuff as well. It's quite small. But
and I don't know if it's only filmed for IMAX, though. Probably wouldn't, would it? But it was amazing to see it in an IMAX theater, I have to say. It was gorgeous.
Just find it fascinating that the Western world is centuries behind the Eastern countries when it comes to knowledge on the health benefits of mushrooms. Have you ever found a decent source of knowledge from Eastern authors, or are there any good books that you'd recommend?
So many good books I recommend, but yeah, I don't know about from Eastern authors. I think that a lot of the authors I have are European and American and Canadian, North American. So many good books out there. I love sharing kind of bibliographies and book recommendations on my notes after my workshops and things. Usually there's a good list of books that have inspired me, because I love learning in that way. I often usually put a lot of links as well to YouTube videos or things I found really interesting or good resources to learn more. Oh, as far as books, yeah, it depends too. I break that down into different categories, whether that's an ID book that you're looking at or seeking out, or whether that's, you know, how to cook mushrooms, culinary recipes, and how to make delicious wild mushroom recipes, or whether it's medicinal mushrooms. There's so many angles, and these books are all so different to each other, what it is you're seeking to learn. But too many books to mention.
Now I get you. No worries.
I can put some books. Maybe I can give some to you that you can put in the show notes.
Yeah, perfect.
At the end, that might be a good way to share them.
That sounds great. Just one last question there. What other things in Ireland do you forage? And like, I see that you make fermented foods just on a regular basis or just throughout the year. Like, what would you go out and pick yourself locally?
Yeah, so I consider myself a professional forager. I make my living teaching people about these wild foods, but also it's a part of my daily practice, usually. Now, maybe not every day. I don't go out foraging every single day, but usually on any given walk, I'm picking nettles, or at the moment, let's see what's out at the moment. At the moment, right now, the flowering currant is out. That's a beautiful red-pink flower that has a very pungent smell, and it makes a very beautiful syrup or cordial that I like to flavor my kombuchas with, or make a drinking shrub with vinegar. It makes a beautiful tea or an infusion. Also, then, of course, the nettles are starting to pop up now. They're in prime, picking beautiful, nutritious superfood of Ireland that's in huge abundance. At the moment, the bramble tips are just starting to get a little longer. It's just starting to kick off, really. The wild garlic's out, of course. The bramble tips, I like to pick, you know, the new young shoot of green growth that still doesn't have a lot of spines, and it's just like maybe a couple of inches long. It's nice and fresh and full of life, and I take those and pick loads of them, and I oxidize them by crushing them and exposing them to oxygen until they brown, like you do with tea, like you do with Camellia sinensis. You have green tea or you have black tea, and that's just through it being oxidized. A lot of these teas that are high in tannins are really nice to oxidize, so it just really deepens the flavor. And bramble tip tea for me was one of my favorite teas to drink on the Wild Biome Project. It was very like a black tea, but a little more fruity as well. And there's so much nutrition and scientific evidence of the potential, the power of brambles, of blackberries and the blackberry plant to give us all kinds of powerful antioxidants and anti-cancer properties as well. So very high in vitamin C. and all kinds of good nutrition in it. So that would be one thing I'll be harvesting soon to make more of. I make, obviously, do loads of ferments and preserves with the wild garlic and the three-quartered leek that are out at the moment. I ferment them, I dehydrate them, I make powders, I make butters, I make so many ways that I can then enjoy it and share with people on my walks and events through the year. Yeah, so basically don't have one answer for that. But an example was having lived wild, exclusively wild food, there was no better way to showcase what can be eaten and saved and preserved and enjoyed, and that it is possible, although not certainly not for all the world, to live off exclusively wild in Ireland. If I needed to, I could survive and eat very well. So yeah, I don't hunt my own venison, the deer, but in this garden here in Glendalough, where we are speaking from at the moment, every night there's like 30 or 40 deer running through my garden. So there's an abundance of venison there that I think Ireland should be eating a lot more of as a very sustainable local wild meat outside of the toxic systems of production that we sometimes have for meat.
And we'd be helping the environment because the deer are basically just eating all the new plants, the new trees, nothing is growing, the population's out of control.
Out of control, so nothing better than to do but be eating it. So even if you are vegetarian, it's an interesting conversation for some who are a vegetarian due to ethical reasons, which I absolutely understand. Yeah, it's a conversation to be had where meat could be local, sustainable, wild, and not kind of living through those conditions that are unsavory in some of our big farming practices. But yeah, so I'll be going down to Kerry soon in a couple of weeks to harvest a lot of seaweed to enjoy through the year.
That's something that I got looking into recently. It's just the thing that puts me off is the preparation again for that.
The picking things is kind of the easy part. But then the going home and processing and drying and fermenting preserving and putting it in a form that you can then enjoy through the year, whether it's freezing it or whatever. It does take a lot of time, but it's so rewarding. Kind of like that's the magic for me. That's the alchemy. That's the preservation, the kind of transformation that then I have that wild food in a form that I can enjoy and share through the year. But I do understand and agree with you. It can be very time consuming.
We would dry them, put it in a salt shaker with the salt. You just get a bit of nutrients in.
Yeah, big time. Great. So good for you.
I see you have some gorse flowers over there.
Yeah.
Are you making some alcohol with it?
No, actually, I was teaching a workshop online the other day. I don't often do very many online workshops. I was asked to do a short fermentation and a short foraging demo. I just had gone out that day and picked 5 or 6 plants that were around me and in super abundance on that day a couple of days ago. So you see the gorse on the kitchen table. Kind of, I guess, for gorse would be something you can make wine from the flowers. But I guess for me, usually it's just a way of adding a little bit of color and flavor to a wild salad or an embellishment. I enjoy the kind of coconutish, little bit of bitter coconutty taste and the burst of color. So if I'm having a wild salad kind of more of an embellishment usually, because it's a lot of picking the flowers to be making a gorse wine. I have done that before, but you get very sore fingers from all the prickles.
It's nearly more hassle than it's worth.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you do these things for love and for exploration. And yeah, there's easier things than gorse flowers. But I do value kind of interacting. And every time I walk past a gorse bush, I will pick off a couple of flowers to eat and chew on while I'm walking. And think a little bit of wild every day is a great thing, even if it's as simple as just chewing on a gorse flower.
No, that's absolutely brilliant. Thanks so much for coming on the podcast. I'm wondering, do you want to plug your social media and can you tell people where to find you and what's on offer?
Yeah, great. Thank you. So I'm based in Wicklow, Ireland, and most of my events are here, although sometimes I do travel around the country for some special collaborations and events. And this year there's a few interesting things in the cards. I'll be up in Antrim doing kind of a bushcraft full weekend, foraging, wild food, bushcrafting and wild camping event. Just put the details of that up live today. I might be in Donegal or Kerry later in the year, but most of the time I'm going to be found here in Wicklow. And I'm most active on my Instagram, which is Hips and Haws Wildcrafts. So I'll just say that slowly because it's a bit of a mouthful, but Hips as in rose hips and Haws as in hawthorn berries. So Hips and Haws Wildcrafts. I have a website, hipsandhaws.com. So on either of those places, if you're not on social media or Facebook, you can find my website and I share the details of my upcoming events and you can kind of get a flavor for the things I've done in the past. I just love offering events, whether that's a workshop or a foraging walk or full day experience, where sometimes I'll be offering some wild greens experiences where we spend the day together foraging. I feed everyone a wild inspired meal and we make food or medicine. We wildcraft some things, some preserves for you to take home with you from that day. So I kind of really love offering those really rich experiences and I really do give it my all. I really enjoy kind of not holding myself back and I don't, I like to give enough time and space that we can really have some time together to get to know each other in these places, sometimes in the forest or sometimes in beautiful venues I hire. Just that sense of, 12 to any number of people gathering for the day with a shared experience is something that I think a lot of people find nourishing in more ways than one. I think we could all do with a bit more of experiences and more people in community and learning things. So I think we could, I know I feel really overrun with things and I don't really want any more things in my life, but experiences, yes, please. I love that. So yeah, I've got plenty of them in all different forms coming up through the year. So you can follow me in those ways.
Well, that's absolutely perfect. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you too.
Thanks for making it this far in the podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. You can support the podcast by sharing this with as many people as possible and to leave a review on the podcast platforms. If you would like to speak on the podcast or know someone with an interesting topic, please get in touch with me on social media. My username is alwaysengaged across all platforms or always-engaged.com. As you may have noticed, I've changed branding for my last podcast from Irish Nature Heritage to Always Engaged. The reason for this is I have a lot of interesting topics in my head and I would like to talk about them that don't necessarily fit under the Irish Nature Heritage brand. So this frees that up. Anyway, thanks and I'll speak to you next time. Slán go fóill.